Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Out of the psychedelic rock groups that defined the close of the 60s rose a more introspective class of musicians who were quieter and often darker than their electric cohorts. With Dylan largely on the sidelines and years of anti-war acid feedback wearing off, a birth existed for a new generation of guitar and piano troubadours, including Elton John, Neil Young, and Carole King. But despite their soothing sounds, many of these artists were often tortured inside, and at various points in their careers hence, they've all but shunted aside songwriting completely. Leading rock journalist Dave Thompson has written extensively on Nirvana, Cream, the Chili Peppers, and others for outlets like Melody Maker and Rolling Stone, as well as several books. His newest is Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Cat Stevens, and the Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter, which is published by Backbeat Books. Dave Thompson, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Why did you want to put these three together in a study for this book?
I think in a way you summed it up in your introduction. Initially, I was just interested in how a generation of music lovers of the late 60s had been so fired up, revolution, things must change, up against the wall. And suddenly the scene or their interest completely switched off, went very introspective, and it was men sitting on stools singing about what color socks they should put on in the morning. I just found that a very fascinating sea change.
Well, the book opens with a salvo from the rock critic Lester Bangs, who was not a fan of James Taylor's, and that much is certain. Was there a backlash against what these troubadours were accomplishing?
I think there was. Well, I mean, there had to be. Whenever you get something that becomes huge, there's always going to be people in a position of sort of media visibility who are going to rail against it. Lester Bangs, I think, was a little more forthright than many people. But even he became more lenient and accepted that, you know, James Taylor sitting there getting stoned every night was in his own way as much of a revolutionary as the Stooges.
You've written about artists from different genres who came after this era, and I wondered, what do they owe to the singer-songwriters, even if musically they might not be on the same page?
There's a great line from David Bowie in like a 1971 live recording where, yeah, he admits he was sitting around listening to Neil Young before writing the next song, and I think it's like Cooks off of Hunky Dory. I think the singer-songwriters allowed musicians who might otherwise have felt very self-conscious about singing personal songs, it allowed them to do that. I mean, Lennon had done it to an extent. I mean, everybody sort of pulled out Help as being, you know, this great sort of personal cry for assistance from Lennon. And, you know, the later into the 60s we got, the more his music became introspective lyrically. But people like James Taylor, actually made it all right for you to go out there and sing a song about, you know, being sad because you missed the bus, which is maybe a little more mundane than James got, but you know what I mean.
Why do you describe this rise as being unlikely? I mean, what was conspiring against this sort of explosion in people standing in coffee houses again?
It was unlikely, A, because it had already happened. You know, as you say, standing in coffee houses again, it was only 6 years since, you know, the last generation had sat in coffee houses listening to Dylan, Joan Baez, Phil Oakes, whoever. So, in a way, the revival of that came a lot faster than I think most rock cycles tend to go. But again, because of what it arrived in the midst of, you know, on the one hand, you know, we go back to the anti-war, you know, the protest revolution stuff. And when you look at what was happening politically in youth culture, I mean, you know, 68 was the year of, you know, riots, mass demonstrations in London. You know, you had that huge march on the American embassy, you know, again, anti-war. And in the midst of this huge march, there's James Taylor sitting in the studio, you know, strumming his guitar and doing Carolina on My Mind. So it was completely at odds with, I think, what anybody would have predicted. You know, the Stones had just come out with Beggar's Banquet. The Who, you know, although Tommy was looming, the Who's live set was full of old rock and roll and blues songs. All the great bands were very hard-edged. You know, the Beatles' Double White album was out, and, you know, probably their most subversive album ever. And in the midst of this, you know, where did it come from? Why?
You trace the arc of each of these men coming to terms with the fact that they are also performers. I mean, you've mentioned James Taylor kind of sitting in the studio, Cat Stevens going to Jamaica to make a weird album that got him out of the London scene, and Jackson Browne really deciding that he can't just give his songs away anymore. I mean, there was a certain amount of reticence on their parts to adopt that kind of rock star mantle.
There was. Cat Stevens' case was very much, you know, once bitten, twice shy. He came along, his first hit was in Britain was in 66, and he'd had a pretty good run of pop hits and pop stardom. Yeah, then he caught tuberculosis, and it's like, if he hadn't caught that, one wonders what would have happened, because he wouldn't have had the time in which to just sit back and say, what the hell am I doing with my career? James Taylor always gave the impression of being a very awkward performer, even though, you know, he'd been doing it for so long. And if you ever look at footage of him, he always looks sort of faintly embarrassed. And almost, I mean, some things, it's like, almost like, how am I getting away with this? He opened for The Who several times, actually. And, I mean, John Entwistle once said that, you know, it was the weirdest thing. There was an audience gathered for The Who, and out in front of them was like this one very tall, skinny guy sitting on a stool strumming an acoustic guitar. So I think performance under those circumstances must have been difficult, simply because the music they were making did not... I mean, it was coffee house music. And taking that out into, you know, the vast auditoriums, it was also very personal music, and having to put that much of your heart and soul into the same songs in the same order with the same comments in between them every night to 5,000-10,000 people could not have been easy. So I think that is why you found James Taylor sort of going off and making an album in his barn and employing one of the workmen to play like the saw on a song. You know, Cat Stevens saying, right, I'm sick of singing, you know, Wild World. I'm going to go off to Jamaica and make, you know, as you said, a very weird concept album. And in the midst of this, you had Jackson Browne, who I think would actually have got going a lot earlier if management had let him. But, you know, management, I think, saw that the singer-songwriter explosion was going to need to change and was going to drift away from what it was originally. And he held Jackson Browne back to sort of kickstart that whole West Coast sound that was so big, you know, a few years later.
You know, this era inspired a lot of imitators, and, you know, it seemed easy. You sit down on a stool with a guitar, and you might even fire up a hit. Who knows? When do you see this era coming to a close, and was it doomed by its accessibility?
Yes, it was. It's the same with everything that becomes, you know, big for 5 minutes. It's like everybody else looks around and says, oh, I can do that. You know, punk in the late 70s, you know, grunge in the 90s. You just get people come along and say, well, I can make that same sort of sound on my guitar. And, you know, I wasn't happy when I woke up this morning. I think I'll write a song about it. And they all get thrown into the marketplace, and people just sort of look at them and say, yeah, one nice song, but, you know, the other guy was better. And they get tired of it, which is why Jackson Browne's move, which was, you know, being held back a couple of years, even though he was ready before then, building up this sensational bunch of songs, but also building up a community of like-minded musicians out in L.A., and, you know, being able to sort of come through at the front of, you know, a whole new variation on the theme, you know, because it's Jackson Browne, there was Eagles, there was Linda Ronstadt, all came through from largely the same stable of artists, you know, same management companies, same record labels, same, you know, home address.
As you look at these artists today, and in our listening area, James Taylor is a huge attraction at Tanglewood. he can sell that place out 365 nights a year if he wants to, right in his backyard, and seems to be at much more peace with performing than he was in your book. But where do you think they are today? I mean, to a certain degree, all three of them are still at it, but there's been a lot of bumps along the way, too.
I think of the three, I mean, James is by far the most visible because he sort of allowed himself to be. You know, he's still James Taylor. Jackson Brown is out there, but I don't know. It feels like people think of Jackson Brown more as a guy who supports good causes and, you know, sings his old songs. And Cat Stevens, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, on the one hand, you know, his last album was great, but there is also the whole, you know, he's a Muslim, is he allowed into the country, blah, 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 all that nonsense, which has very much soured, I think, people's perception of him.
We've been speaking with rock journalist Dave Thompson. He's the author of Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Brown, Cat Stevens, and The Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter, a book published by Backbeat. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show and to ask you about this era, and it was a great read, too, so thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.